Triumphs and tragedies have forged the heart and soul of David Holt, musician, songwriter, storyteller, and host of the PBS TV series Great American Railway Journeys. A sampler of his credits includes the syndicated radio show Riverwalk, recorded live in San Antonio, Texas, and numerous television series, including Fire on the Mountain and The American Music Shop. Holt was also a regular guest performer on Hee Haw from 1980 through 89. Along the way, he's racked up 4 Grammy Awards, including 9 nominations. I'm Tom Wilmer. Join me for a conversation with David Holt.
When I was 21, I was going to San Francisco State, and I had dropped out of college to teach at a private elementary school and out in Martinez, California. And as it happened, just by a total random act of violence, 3 guys jumped out of a car one evening and just beat me up and left me for dead. That changed my life. Now, that changed my life.
That's a big one.
Yeah. And I had been playing rock and roll drums up to that point. And from there, I guess I felt just recovering back into society, I got interested in cowboy music. And I went back to find the earliest cowboy singer ever to record. He was actually the first. His name was Carl Sprague, and he lived in Bryan, Texas. And so I went back there and met this old man who taught me how to play the cowboy strum on the guitar and taught me to play the harmonica with stuff like things like that old-timey style. And from that, I got excited about learning from old folks, realizing that if you didn't have your heroes be celebrities, if they were just sort of your own kind of celebrity, then you could go visit them, and they would show you and teach you. And so when I was at UCSB, I met Ralph Stanley. He came out and did a concert, the bluegrass banjo picker. And I asked him after the concert, where can I go to learn the clawhammer style? This is the style that his mother played, something like this. As opposed to the three-finger style. And Ralph said, you need to go back to the Southern Mountains if you want to learn that stuff. He said, Galax is a great place. Asheville has a lot of music. Mount Airy, Roanoke. And so that was the summer of 69. Mm-hmm. I went back there in my old 52 Chevy and just fell in love with the place and the people and the music.
So you spent a whole summer just traveling around Southern Appalachian
communities. From Georgia to West Virginia. We went to fiddlers conventions every weekend, and in those days there was one every weekend. And people at the convention would say, come stay a week with us. Now, we didn't realize that was just a saying. You know, they didn't really mean to come stay a week with them, and we'd go stay a week with them. And then on the weekends, we'd go to the fiddlers conventions. And my friend Steve Keith and I did this all summer long and just fell in love with the place.
So, and like to say, you never came back.
Never came back. I came back and finished I have degrees in biology and art from the College of Creative Studies at UCSB, and then actually went back and got a fifth-year teaching credential just so I could have something to do. Mm-hmm. And then I just moved to Asheville with no thought of making a living. Wow. This is Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah. So what did you do?
Since I was an art major, I got a job as a sign maker, and I just worked hard in the daytimes and practiced like crazy in the night and went around and visited all the old-timers there. Now, this is 1973 when I finally moved there. And there were all these old folks that were still alive that were born in the late 1800s. People like Delly Norton, who was an old ballad singer that had the ballads passed down in her family for 400 years. People like Bard Ray, who was an old banjo player and picker from this little community called Sodom, North Carolina.
Oh.
And people like Etta Baker, who was a fingerstyle guitar player. And I got to meet Doc Watson in those very early days. I just sort of realized I'd stumbled on, in my mind, sort of a lost world, a world that was going to be lost pretty soon. You know, when all these people died, it was there was a pretty much a big gap between the old folks then and who was playing the traditional mountain music. So I just started learning it, started mm-hmm. slowly making a living playing it.
Did you do recording of any of the old guys?
Oh, yeah. But unfortunately, we didn't have great equipment like you've got here. I had to start an old cassette player, you know. Mm-hmm. But most of my stuff is at the Library of Congress, and then all the rest of it will be at the Southern Folklore Archive at UNC Chapel Hill. I have It could fill this room, the amount of stuff I've collected and videotaped and that kind of thing.
And then something happened. There was a shift in your life. All of a sudden you're on Hee Haw and TNN. How did that happen?
Well, you know, what happened is I got to Asheville, North Carolina. The musicians there were in factions. Like the bluegrass guys wouldn't talk to the old-time guys. They didn't even know about the ballad singers. And I happened to be a guy from the outside. And it was so unusual that a guy would come from California to learn this old music that I had an inside front cover of the newspaper with a picture, probably an 8x10 picture, and a whole page telling about me coming there. That was so such
rare
news. Yeah. And so I guess that really got me started to getting out and playing, because after people saw that article, then they started asking me to play.
Tell us about Hee Haw.
That was pretty amazing. Let's see, how did that come about? I was asked to do a show on public television in North Carolina called Folkways, and that show is still on the air. You can look it up. The show is called Folkways. So that show's been showing for almost 40 years
wow.
now. I guess the Hee Haw thing came about in part because of that. I was teaching at Warren Wilson College, teaching this Appalachian music program. And so I took my class of country music history class down to the Opry, and we were watching it, and I said, you know, they need to get some old-time music on there. They didn't really have any old-time music, and that's what started the Opry, you know, people like Uncle Dave Macon and things like that. And so I called the manager of the Opry, Hal Durham, and I said, you know, I think you ought to have more old-time music on the show. He said, well, I'd like to, but he said, I don't know anybody that plays. And I said, well, I do. So my friend Ann Romaine said, if you go down there and visit Hal Durham and play for him, you wear what you're going to wear on the stage that night. So I got a white suit and a white hat and this fancy new banjo and went down there and played for Hal, and he put me on the Opry. And from that, they got me on Hee Haw.
That went on for
that four. Went on to the end of the Hee Haw era, which was about 1980 to about 1989, something like that. Yeah, I was on 50 times, I think. And that was just a pleasure to do that because I got to meet my heroes and work with them, Roy Acuff and Tennessee Ernie Ford and Grandpa Jones and those folks. It was really great.
Tell me about TNN.
So this is when cable was new. We're talking 1984. Cable was just coming on the air, and they had no idea which channels were going to be successful and which ones weren't. And I remember going to one of the first cable conventions. You know, it was MTV, TNN, which is the network that I was working for, Nashville Network, CNN. It was all new. TNN happened to be quite successful in the country music market. And I had a show called Fire on the Mountain, which was the only, and pretty much has been, the only mountain music and bluegrass show ever. We made 95 half-hour shows. Unfortunately, CBS has those tapes and has never released them again. But you can look on the internet, on YouTube, and find, you can either look on my name, David Holt, or just Fire on the Mountain, and they'll come up. And so that show was really valuable to me because I got to meet everybody. They were on my show. I was hosting it, so that kind of gave me a certain cachet. And that's where I got to meet Doc Watson up close and personal and play with him. We just loved playing together. Our rhythm just hooked in, and Merle was alive at that time, and we had him on the show twice, and that proved to be important later on.
To jump forward a little bit, since 2004, you've hosted the Great Scenic Railway series on PBS.
Yeah.
And that's actually part of the reason you're here in San Luis Obispo today.
Right, up here to do the Central Coast Railroad Festival. This is a show that producer Rob Van Camp put together where we go and look at scenic trains basically around the country. And there's hundreds of them. Some of the more famous ones are like the Durango-Silverton, Colorado ride. And it's been fascinating for me because I didn't really know much about trains. Of course, I knew a lot of the music about trains because that's half the traditional music category has something to do with trains. It's been really fun to go visit these trains and ride them. And to me, a train is about as animate as an inanimate object can be. It's just like a musical instrument. They've all got personalities, and they've all got quirks, and you got to put up with the quirks and figure out how to work with them. So I've really learned to love the trains.
And the definitive rhythm, too, right?
Oh, man, the rhythm is so important.
Yeah.
You can hear it in the harmonica where the old sort of German style or Irish style of harmonica would be like, wait, let me get it going here. That'd be like the old cowboy sort of style of harmonica. But when the trains came in, the mountain people, and black folks particularly, first heard that rhythm, and they just started trying to imitate the train, like, and they could get rhythms like. And that really changed the music. You can hear it most clearly in the harmonica, but it certainly affected the way the banjo was played, too, and the fiddle, all of that.
Give us an example, a banjo example.
Okay. So this is a good combination of the harmonica, the banjo, and the African-American influence on mountain music. Here's an old tune called Cotton Eye Joe. Well, 18, 19, 20 years ago, Daddy worked a man called Cotton Eye Joe. Don't you remember, don't you know, Daddy worked a man called Cotton Eye Joe. Where did you come from, where did you go, where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? Everybody love old Cotton Eye Joe. Whenever there's a dance, the women want to go. They all want to dance with Cotton Eye Joe. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from? Cotton Eye Joe. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from? Cotton Eye Joe.
Nice.
Yeah, it sort of gives you a little sense of how the blues and the trains affected the music.
Mm-hmm. Dig a little deeper on the Great Railway Scenic Journeys. Do you record everything live with the cameraman with you on the train? And
yeah.
You're interviewing people as the train is rolling?
We've been doing it, as you said, since 2004, so there's been a lot of different ways we've done it. Sometimes I'm actually on the train, and the producer is there. He's also the videographer, and he's usually shot most of the train before I get there. And then I do what we call the stand-ups, you know, the host talking to the audience. And then another way we do it is he'll go out and, for example, he did all of New Zealand in their scenic trains, and I couldn't go on that trip. So he shot New Zealand and photographed the trains. Then I did the stand-ups in a museum in Sacramento, which is a beautiful railroad museum, probably the best in the country. And so we do it different ways.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to your television work that you do ongoing, do you regularly do live concerts and performances around the country?
That's really how I make my living. And, you know, I used to travel all over the world, really, and a lot out west. But in the last, since 9/11, when travel started getting hard, you know, I carry a steel guitar, a wood body guitar, and a banjo, and all kind of other instruments in my suitcase. I have a lot of stuff. It's hard to tote around. So I've been really concentrating on making a living in the Southeast. And luckily I've been able to do it because of those television shows I was telling you about. Mm-hmm. Especially the folkways. In North Carolina, I can pretty much draw an audience. And that's been a real blessing for not having to travel as far, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. by air. You know, I can drive most places now.
Talk to us about Ferrum College and the folkways that goes on there. That's an incredible program. And I understand you're involved directly and indirectly there.
You talking about Roddy?
Yeah.
They have a great program, and one of their great things that they do is a festival every year with every kind of event you can imagine, from molasses making to, you know, how you make moonshine to. They have a really good instrument collection of old. In fact, you know, I have one of the instruments that Roddy really loves. Let me get this thing down here. Mm-hmm. This is a banjo that was made in the 1870s. It's an old mountain banjo. And if you can kind of picture it, it's just got a 6-inch head instead of a big, you know, 11-inch head. The head is a groundhog hide. The thing is made completely of wood. Just a few screws in it is the only metal parts. This is the instrument that the mountain boys made when they came back from the Civil War, having seen fancier banjos but having no way to make them. So the old ones had cat guts for strings. This just has, you know, plastic strings, but it's got a wonderful sound. Listen to this. Well, my name is Georgia Buck. Never had no luck. Always been treated this way. Oh. Always been treated this way. I said, oh, me, oh, Lord, am I always been treated this way.
pass away. Well, now Georgia Buck is dead, and the last words he said was, "Dig me a hole in the ground, boys. Dig me a hole in the ground." I said, "Oh, me, oh, Lord, am I, dig me a hole in the ground." I said, "Oh, me, oh, Lord, am I, dig me a hole in the ground."
That's quite an unusual sound, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. And you know what I was thinking as you were playing is, they didn't have video recorders back post-Civil War.
Right.
But this is about as close as it comes to time travel in an auditory sense, isn't it?
It is. And it actually is. That's a really good point, Tom, because to me, when I'm playing this music, I'm thinking about the old time as I learned it from. And usually when I do a concert, I bring photographs of the old folks. I love photography, too, and I studied that in college. So I have all these great, I like them, black and white photographs of the old timers I learned from. When I'm putting together a concert, I've got these big pictures that I hold up and show the audience, and I'm thinking about each one of those people, you know, just kind of hoping their spirits are standing behind me, cheering me on and leading me through the concert.
Well, you most definitely are breathing life into their lives, yeah.
Well, they were important to me. These were some wonderful people who had, you know, sometimes no schooling at all, but had a PhD in common sense. I mean, somebody like Doc Watson, Doc went to school when he was 10 years old for the first time. He stayed 3 years, and then he dropped out. This is the blind school in Raleigh, and went back home to his home in Deep Gap, North Carolina. And then one of the teachers said, "Son," his name was Arthel, he wasn't called Doc yet. She said, "Arthel, now you can keep your education going because there's all kind of books on records, and you can get those records from the state and listen to them." And he did that for his whole life. He was very well educated, self-educated. Of course, he was kind of a genius level person, but, you know, he took his own education into his own hands and did a great job with it, I think.
You talk about Roy Acuff and others who were mentors to you, either directly or indirectly. And Doc Watson, obviously, is one of your seminal mentors. In what ways, tangibly, did Doc infuse something into your life, your music?
Man, it just goes, it's all over the map. And I can tell you, musically, first of all, the rhythm was so important, and his sense of kind of inhabiting every note that he played. He never just threw off a tune off of his cuff. He would really get in there and play every time he played it. I don't care if it was for a sound check or what, he was really playing that tune. That taught me a lot, to be present in the music that you're playing. He had a masterful way of doing that. And also of leaving out certain notes. Don't overcrowd the tune with just fancy notes. You know, Doc could take an old tune and make it sound new, or a new tune and make it sound old, and he was just a master at that. And that, I think that's what I've tried to do, is not play it just like an old recording, but to try to play it from inside me. And I think that's what Doc always did, too. He said, if I liked a tune, I'll learn it, I'll play it. It didn't have to be particularly old-time music. He just loved that. He loved the old stuff. I learned those kinds of things, and I learned to always pick up my feet when I walk. You know, a blind person never shuffles their feet. He picks them up, puts them down. I mean, he could walk over a stone, you know, courtyard and never stumble or anything. I learned so many things from Doc. It's just endless, really.
There's the old classics, Flat and Scruggs, and you talk about Earl Scruggs being a real character in your life.
Yeah.
How did he influence you?
I got to know Earl pretty well, and Earl was just a very quiet, wonderful guy, a great storyteller when you could get him going. But I think musically, the way Earl influenced me was, well, non-musically, was his humble attitude. He was a very humble person and a very sweet guy. Musically, he probably had the best rhythm of just about anybody I've ever come across, because he was playing a very complicated three-finger style, and he loved, oddly enough, to play it along with a clawhammer player like I play, because the two styles fit beautifully together. I think I would say rhythm would be the main thing, but just a sense of the kind of guy that Earl was. When Doc came down to Nashville to do that, it was a record they did with Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, instrumental called Strictly Instrumental. They were getting ready to go in the studio, and Doc had an attack of appendicitis that put him in the hospital, and almost died. And Earl went to the Opry Foundation and he said, you know, I know you don't know this guy, Doc Watson, but he's a wonderful player. He's a mountain boy and he doesn't have any money and we need to support him. And Earl raised the money to pay for the hospitalization. And he never would tell about that because he thought that would sort of embarrass Doc. But Doc was, you know, just pleased as punch that Earl did that. I mean, it saved him. And you know, that's the kind of guy Earl was.
Very cool.
Very humble.
Yeah. Back to instruments. I understand that you play at least 10 different acoustic instruments.
Yeah, I guess maybe. But the main ones I really concentrate on are the banjo, the clawhammer banjo style, the slide guitar, which is made right here in San Luis Obispo.
I understand that you personally own 7 national guitars, as I remember.
Oh, boy. Probably at least. Yeah, I love these things. And most people who have them are sort of addicted to them and have more than one. So if you haven't seen a national resophonic guitar, take a look on the internet. It's a steel-bodied instrument, and they made them out of steel because they were trying to make the loudest guitar they could make before they had pickups on guitars. And so they were made really to play Hawaiian music on. That was the original idea. Late 20s, they started making them. In Los Angeles, as a matter of fact, the Dopiro brothers pretty much put the design together. And then later on, McGregor Gaines and Don Young got the name and all the extra parts and machines that could still be used, and then they've blossomed that factory into an incredible business.
As I recall, that Don Young, when he was young, worked for the Dobro Brothers.
That's right, he did. Right?
Yeah. A little deeper word picture on the national guitar, because it is so classic and distinctive, the Pi-10 resonator.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people, if they can't picture it in their mind, can remember that Mark Knopfler record or the Dire Straits record of... he's holding a national guitar on the front of it. It's silver-looking, very beautiful, actually made of brass and coated in nickel. And can be played like a regular guitar, but it's got kind of a brassy metallic sound. And what's really great for is the slide. I just have a metal bar on my finger, a brass, like a brass pipe. And I'll just play it. Well, actually, you know what, Tom? This guitar, in a way, saved my life. We lost our daughter in 1989 is what I'm trying to say, and in a car accident. And somebody gave me one of these guitars. And I didn't know how to play it, but I knew it was used for playing blues. And, buddy, I had the blues like nobody's business. So I'd sit around and play things like this. And it really helped me. And finally, I realized, getting up every morning and watching the sunrise and just feeling so sad, that I was actually learning how to play this instrument. And I put together this song called The Steel Guitar Blues. Talk about it, I will listen till you're through. But if words no longer say it, let me tell you what I always do. I just break off another bottleneck and play these steel guitar blues. People say, ooh, snap out of it. Oh, that's easier said than done. While you can hardly move, they're in a world of fun. Sometimes I think it's better just to sink way down in your funky mood, till you can rise up humming these old steel guitar blues. Now you can try to keep it all inside with drinking drugs and cigarettes, but you know that's not gonna get us where we want to get. But I have some medicine here, might shake things loose. the morning after a dose of these steel guitar blues. Open up now. So by playing the, you know, working on the steel guitar just gave me, and it really kind of gave me a reason to live. Very odd to say, but I was so sad from, you know, Sarah Jane was just 10 years old when she died, and man, it just brought me down. I was 43 years old. That sort of took a huge chunk out of my life at that point for years.
Yeah.
But the guitar saved me.
Nice. Talk to us a moment about the banjo, the classic banjo.
Yeah.
And maybe give us a sampler of something that you've written and that you're most proud of on the banjo.
You know what? I've written most of the songs I've done on the steel guitar and the regular acoustic guitar. The banjo's what got me into this music, and I still love playing the traditional tunes or traditional songs. Let me just play one of these old fiddle tunes, because in the clawhammer style, which is basically working on a rhythm like this, you can get quite a lot of melody, something like this. Here's an old tune. First tune recorded on the Grand Ole Opry, as a matter of fact, by Uncle Billy Thompson. Actually, the tune Billy Wilson, that it was from Uncle Jimmy Thompson, when he played the Opry that very first night, November 28th, 1925, he played that tune.
Nice.
And I might add that I'm playing a Deering banjo, which is made, you know, in California, down around San Diego.
Oh.
They've been very kind to me and built a design that I created of a very deep pot. You see that, how it's 4 inches deep?
So that's your design then?
Yeah, And no metal tone ring, so it's got a very warm but bright sound. It's a great banjo. I have not found a better one.
Nice.
I appreciate those folks. They're great people down there. Deering banjo.
Mm-hmm. You know, a whole nother dimension of David Holt and me is storytelling.
Yeah.
And that's something that has been and remains very close to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about the American idiom of storytelling, especially the Appalachian style.
Yeah, you know, I got into storytelling because I was collecting music, and then I was performing the music, and whenever somebody taught me a tune or something, there was always a story that went along with it, almost always, about the person they learned it from, or maybe if it was Tom Dooley, something like that, there would be a historical story. And I started telling those in concert and realizing, man, this is powerful. And then I started hearing folk tales, things like the Taily Bone and the Hairy Man and things like that. And I started telling those in concert and realized people really were just aching to hear traditional stories now. It's something gone, almost gone, unless you seek it out. Then in 1976, I got invited to the National Storytelling Festival. It had just started 3 years before, so there were just 150 people there. But it was the beginning of the storytelling revival. And there I met people like Gamble Rogers and Catherine Windham and Connie and Barbara, Connie Reagan Blake and Barbara Freeman, and realized there were other people that were trying to make a living telling stories. And so I began to incorporate storytelling into my performances, and then would sometimes just do flat-out storytelling festivals, which is that was the focus of the whole thing. Yeah, and I was the guy that added music to it, but I still love storytelling and still love going to those festivals.
I'm on my way to Tennessee in a week.
Oh, what you gonna do?
And Northeast. Well, just check out whole Northeast Tennessee. But one of the places is I read about you can get a master's in storytelling.
That's right, at ETSU.
Pretty,
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Yeah. It's still a growing movement, and the National Festival in Jonesboro still goes on the first weekend of October every year. And now there's a big one out in Timpanogos out in Utah near Orem. I'm going to that one this coming summer, telling there, and it's quite a movement.
Give us your favorite, your best pick, tight little story.
Oh, a tight little story. Yeah, because they're mostly a little bit longer. Well, I'll tell you one I heard from Liz Weir that I really like. I went over to Ireland a couple of years ago to play this Cape Clear Storytelling Festival, which is on an island off the coast of Ireland. I mean, very exotic. And I was looking for stories that didn't make it to America, because you know that most of our stories are from Ireland, England, Scotland, Germany, places like that. So she told me about a story that happened in County Mayo when the potato famine hit. It was 1846, you know, everybody was starving, and there was a young man that was so poor before the famine even happened that he had to live with his parents, he and his wife did. And like every family, they had known some sorrow. His mother had been blind for 10 years, and he and his wife had been married for 6 and never had a baby, and he wanted a baby more than anything in the world. And so then the potato famine hit, and all he could think about was finding food for his family. There were no potatoes, and in those days, if you wanted to go find food on the landlord's property, hunt a deer or anything like that, you would be hanged if you were caught. Couldn't fish or anything, so his family was starving. So one morning he got up, he wasn't a hunter, all he had was a little axe, and he picked up a little axe that he had there by the fireplace, and he went off to the landlord's property, climbed over the big tall stone wall, and began walking the property, hiding, being very careful, because he knew he'd be hanged if he was caught. He threw that axe at a rabbit, he threw it at a squirrel, of course he missed, and by the end of the day he was coming home completely discouraged. When he looked up and in the middle of a big meadow with mist rising off of it was a huge stag, completely white with a big rack of antlers. He thought this might be a pet, so he snuck up behind the rocks and trees and got right up to that big white stag, and he raised the axe over his head. He was just about to bring it down on the deer's head when the deer simply looked up and said, "Don't." He stepped back, thinking he was hallucinating. The deer said, "Don't kill me, and I'll give you one wish." Well, the man raised the axe higher, thinking he would have a lot of food if he killed this deer. The deer said, "Yes, you will have some meat if you kill me. But if you save one wish, you can keep your family alive forever." Well, the young man stepped back. The deer said, "I will wait for you here in the morning for your decision." The man started running across the field. He came to the wall. He climbed over the wall. He started running home. He saw his father along the way. He told his father what happened. His father said, "That's wonderful, son. This is what we've been praying for." He said, "You must go back tomorrow and wish for gold, because if we have gold, we can have anything we want." Well, he loved and respected his father, but he wanted to talk to his mother, too, and he ran home and told his mother what happened. She said, "Son, this is what I've been praying for. You must go back and wish that I can have my sight back. I've not been able to see for 10 years. His wife heard him talking to his mother. She pulled him aside. She said, "Husband, if we don't have a baby, this family will disappear. You must go back and wish for a baby." Well, that night, the man tossed and turned. He couldn't sleep at all. He got up the next morning without having slept a wink, and he picked up that axe, not knowing exactly what he was going to do. But he went to the wall, and he climbed over the wall and went through the forest until he found that big meadow with mist rising off of it, and he looked up, and he saw the big white stag still in the middle of the meadow. The deer looked up and said, "Have you made your decision?" He said, yes, I've decided to take the one wish." The stag said, "Make the wish, and it shall be granted." He said, "I wish that my mother could see my wife rocking our new baby in a solid gold cradle." The wish was granted, and they lived happily ever after. Nice. And that's a folk tale, you know. I love to tell true life stories as well.
My mom, years ago, sent me Stella Luna.
Oh, yeah?
Tell us about that.
Well, Stella Luna was one of the most popular children's books of all time, and we got the rights to put it on recording and add music to it. That's the one that won the Grammy in the children's category that year. I'm not sure when that was. And then the one that was so exciting to me was I recorded Doc Watson in a live concert with the two of us, and then took him into the studio and spent a day just talking to him about his life, because Doc never wanted to have his autobiography written. He just didn't. I said, well, you just say it then. You just tell us your life story. That became the Legacy CDs, and he's talking about the songs that were important and playing those songs and then telling the stories about the songs. 3-CD set with a 76-page booklet, and it's ended up, now that Doc's gone, being his biography. I'm so proud of that one, and so proud we got Doc at that time when he was completely lucid and 76 years old, still playing great, and we won the Grammy for that one. That was very exciting for me and for Doc. We really love that.
And how many times in your life have you missed that opportunity, that best intention? You know, gee, yeah. We should do this.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's awesome that happened.
I learned my lesson on that because I spent my whole life being around old people, old musicians. And I learned that lesson very early on when I went to go visit a black fiddler who lived there in Asheville. And the day I called him to go see him, his wife said, well, honey, he died this morning. Wow. I said, oh, man, I'm not going to ever let that happen again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I got to know some of the oldest person in the world. She was 122.
Whoa.
And I would go down and see her in Wilmington, and I just made a point of it to go every other month and just go. Just the mm-hmm. next 2 years, I did that every other month till she passed away, because chances like that don't come very often.
Mm-hmm. You touched on the black tradition in music in the Appalachians, in the South.
Yeah.
Talk a little deeper about that, because that's so profound, going back to that slave tradition. Yeah. It's just powerful.
It's the underlying foundation of the music. That and the English, Scotch, Irish music mixed with the African American is what makes it what it is. Without that, it would sound more like Scottish or Irish music. Well, we have that, you know, everything from the hambone rhythms. They come from black tradition, to things like this style of guitar. Our finger-picking style of guitar that we now associate with Doc Watson, Chet Atkins, Merle Travis, came from people like Etta Baker's family. There were many folks like Etta that played this style of guitar, but they were the ones that really created it. You play the bass notes with your thumb, and you play the melody notes with your middle and index finger. So mean and so bad, took a swing at his mama, took a shot at his dad, and then he ride. Oh, railroad Bill, lights his cigar with a $10 bill, and then he ride. Etta had this beautiful lick that went. So that style of guitar playing that she still played, I mean, you know, Etta passed away in 2006 at 93, and she had been playing guitar an hour a day since she was 3 years old. And she had learned from her father and grandfather, who was born in the 1860s. So we're hearing something that's directly from the 1800s, because she didn't know the names of the chords or the names of the notes. She just learned what they played. And then that style of playing became, you know, like Merle Travis would play something like. Fancier, and then of course Doc learned a lot from Merle Travis, and as I was saying, he could take a new tune and make it sound older, an old song and make it sound new. And this is let me just do a little bit of this. It was a song he heard Crystal Gayle do. And he thought, man, that would make a great finger picking piece. And Doc was interesting because he didn't like to teach guitar. He couldn't see what you were doing, and he had learned his by just messing around. If he wanted a chord that sounded like this, or a chord that sounded like this, he would just fool around on the guitar until he found it. He didn't look in a book or ask anybody, you know. So this song is full of odd formations. I've got to tell you, I've been racking my brain. I've got to find a way out. I'm getting tired of this continual rain. A change is coming, no doubt. It's been a too long time with no peace of mind, and I'm ready for the times to get better. A long, lonely time with no peace of mind, and I'm ready for the times to get better. Take from me what I cannot give. No happiness can I find. I've got a dream that I am trying to live. It's burning holes in my mind. It's been a too long time with no peace of mind, and I'm ready for the times to get better. A long, lonely time of mine, and I'm ready for the time to get better.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Yeah, just, yeah. I always think about Doc when I'm playing that one, yeah.
David Holt, gosh, I feel like I want to hog your time and keep you here for another hour. But
it's been great talking to you.
Yeah,
Tom.
But you have somebody waiting for you. So I'm going to have to let you go.
Okay, well, it's great being here. Thanks for talking to me.
It's been my absolute honor. We've been speaking with David Holt. For further information, davidholt.com.
Yeah, davidholt.com. We've got a lot of the photographs I was talking to you about, a whole little section on my website about the mentors I learned from, stories about them. Check it out. It's a lot of neat stuff.
Excellent. Thanks again, David. You made my day.
Thanks, Tom.